sports, entertainment, and Maine's best guest list on The Pulse, AM 620 WZON, WZONThePulse.com, and the WZON app. This is Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Good morning. Welcome in. It's the best of Downtown on a Sunday morning, 22nd day of October. I'm Rich Kimball here with Kerry Haskell, Downtown and the best of Downtown, brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Guests of the program are heard on the G&M Family Market phone line. G&M on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden, open every day, 6 in the morning until 9 o'clock at night. It's our weekly Sunday morning look back at some of our favorite conversations from the past week. And we'll cover a lot of bases today. We'll talk about Hollywood and specifically the role of women in film with actress Ileana Douglas. Damon Krakowski, a member of the band Galaxy 500, podcast host and author of a very interesting book, The New Analog, will join us later in the program. But we get things rolling by talking football this morning. It's a rematch of the Super Bowl this evening. Sunday Night Football, Patriots and the Atlanta Falcons. And to get us all ready for that, we talked earlier this week with the radio voice of the Patriots, our friend Bob Soucy. Let's get caught up on what's going on here. It's going to be one of the stranger 4-2 starts to a season that you've experienced.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think you get accustomed to the strange things with the Patriots, and generally good things, of course. But it seems as though every year, this being season number 5 for me, there have been some storylines that are definitely out of the ordinary. And this year, at 4-2 in first place, it's a disappointment coming off a Super Bowl championship with the outsized expectations by some or hopes that the Patriots could possibly run the table during the regular season. But, you know, when you think about it, there are concerns, and this team has not turned the corner yet defensively. And if they go from the best scoring defense in the league to one of the worst, and a team that really has struggled game to game, allowing 300 yards to every quarterback, including Josh McCown and the Jets last week. And yet, I think they're starting to make some progress there. And offensively, they haven't played their best the last couple of weeks against the Buccaneers or the Jets, but they've done enough. And you still see that, you know, the numbers offensively, and they're still pretty remarkable, all things considered.
Well, let's talk about that defense as they take on Matty Ryan this week, and a defense that looks like it's going to be without the services of both Gilmore and Rowe. Who does that put the pressure on?
Well, it's a good question, Rich, if indeed that's the case. You know, those guys haven't been able to practice early in the week, and we know Eric Rowe last year, for example, in the Super Bowl, was assigned to Julio Jones down the stretch. When Jones made that incredible catch along the sideline in the fourth quarter, Eric Rowe was in excellent position and really did a great job in that game of trying to cover Julio Jones. But he's been bothered by the groin injury. And Stephon Gilmore, a longer cornerback with, I think, teams like the Falcons with big receivers like Julio Jones and physical receivers like Mohamed Sanu, they're part of the reason why I think the Patriots went out and really had an interest in Stephon Gilmore, trying to match up with a longer cornerback like him. And it puts a big strain on this defense. Johnson Bademos did a nice job last week against the Jets. Different kind of offense, as inconsistent as the Falcons have been, much different personnel this weekend. Johnson had only started 3 games at cornerback in his entire career, none throughout his 4 years with the Cleveland Browns before signing with Detroit. Again, he did a nice job last week for the Pats without playing any defensive snaps in the first 5 weeks of the season, but it's a much different task against the Atlanta Falcons.
And for the offense this week, well, priority one might be to keep those guys from beating on number 12. He's taken some shots this year through 6 games.
Yeah, Rich, it's a great concern for the Pats. They did a much better job against the Jets. Now, one of the things that stands out in terms of how they protected him against the Jets is that they used their backs a lot to stay in and pass protect. But as we know, a big key for the Patriots in coming back against Atlanta in the Super Bowl is the performance of James White. You hope that the Patriots are able to protect Brady this week against the Falcons, who are coming off their first game in the last 19 where they didn't have at least one quarterback sack. I think they had a run of 8 straight games with at least 2. But they've had some injuries along that defensive line, and they may get Courtney Upshaw back, and he's, of course, a guy that we've seen with the Ravens and the Falcons do some damage against the Pats. Grady Jarrett had a tremendous Super Bowl last year. There's a lot of quickness and speed on that defense. And so they have that potential to pose real problems for the Patriots. You know, not like the Jets last week with the size matchups, but in this case, because of the speed. And you just wonder how the Patriots are going to try to adjust with no Julian Edelman in the lineup, and if they have to use James White and or Deion Lewis to stay in and block more rather than run pass routes.
We're talking with Bob Soucy, voice of the Patriots here on Downtown. You bring up Deion Lewis, and I saw you commenting on this on social media the other day as well. For a guy of his size, boy, he's an awfully strong guy.
He is, Rich. He's a really exciting player to watch, and you know he's a fantastic athlete, very elusive. We watch the jump cuts that he makes, the ability to make people miss in the open space. But one of the things that I think is easily overlooked is just how strong he is, how many tackles he breaks. He really has been the toughest back to bring down for the Patriots when healthy in 2015 and thus far this season. And we saw him running between the tackles well against the Jets, and I think that was a big part of the Patriots' success. And that's also a factor in trying to protect Tom Brady. On the two scoring drives the Patriots had to come back and tie it, Deion ran for 40 yards combined, including a one-yard touchdown run. Again, absorbing contact, still fighting his way into the end zone on that particular play. So he is a guy who might be short, but as he says, he's not small, and he is certainly very strong.
This is a team that people forget has had a remarkable streak going back a while of road victories.
11 in a row, pretty remarkable. Just one short of the franchise record. It's kind of interesting when the Patriots headed out to the Meadowlands to play the Jets last week, they had won 10 straight, of course, on the road, whereas they had gone 6-4 in their last 10 home games. And now they're facing the Atlanta Falcons, who come up to New England having lost their last two at home to AFC East squads. So I'm not sure what that means for both of these teams and overall the NFL, but road teams are winning more frequently these days, and certainly the Patriots have won a lot of road games. So they ran the table on the road last year and thus far off to a good start away from home this season. And maybe that bodes well for them because we know when they come out of the bye after the midpoint of the season, they're going to play 5 of 6 away from home.
Bob, who's been the most pleasant surprise for you on the Patriots so far this season?
Wow, the most pleasant surprise on this year's Patriots team. That's a really tough question to answer because I think there have been guys who've unfortunately been unpleasant surprises thus far. And one would be, for example, the tight end Dwayne Allen, who's yet to catch a pass. He's been targeted only about a half dozen times. And I think Mike Gillisley, after the start with the 3 touchdowns in the first game, hasn't maybe had the opportunities to be as productive as we thought he might be. There were some acquisitions in the preseason as well, or the offseason, like Coney Gilley and David Harris. I think fall into that category. And as I rattle off names, I'm trying to scan my brain as well as the rest of the roster for that most pleasant surprise. And, when I just think about players for the Patriots who've done well to this point, generally they're the guys you expect to do well. Maybe the consistency that Chris Hogan's enjoyed thus far, last year, a deep ball receiver, big play guy for the Pats, but this season he's been there on a week in, week out basis for Brady and really has done a terrific job. I look at the defensive side of the ball and we've discussed a little bit the issues there. So it's really hard to pinpoint a guy on the defense and say, he's been a pleasant surprise. Maybe, you look at the rookie class, Rich, Dietrich Wise, pressure he's been able to generate for the most part. Adam Butler, undrafted free agent out of Vanderbilt. So they're rookies, they're getting quality reps. And we saw Butler pressure Josh McCown last week early in the game and force an incompletion. And we saw Dietrich Wise, of course, in the first 6 weeks get pretty good pressure on the quarterback as well. So I guess those two guys qualify for me.
You mentioned Coney Ealy. Was I reading too much into this, or did he seem to enjoy it even more than usual when he got to the quarterback last week?
Well, I think everybody, in sports has, that competitive chip on his or her shoulder when, they feel like somebody might have shown either disrespect, and sometimes it's manufactured, of course, or just add to the motivation, or, you're left off a roster, you don't make a team, and you want to prove yourself and you have a chance to play against that team. And also, perhaps Ealy was playing with a lot of motivation, but, he looked pretty happy when he was making plays against the Jacksonville Jaguars a couple of weeks earlier, too. So I don't read too much into that. Uh, he, you know, he's having a good run with the Jets. It's a good start for him. You know, maybe a better defense for him to be in as a situational guy, primarily try to get after the quarterback once the Jets use their sub-personnel and play with an extra defensive back on the field. So, you know, it's a role that suits him well, whereas the Patriots are asking him to do a lot of different things. I will say this. I think, you know, during the week, although he did articulate that he was looking forward to playing against the Patriots, he also seemed to show what I thought was, you know, just respect for the path for Tom Brady and the organization. So, I guess, like I said, baseball, football, basketball, the guy gets traded from one team to another, he gets let go by somebody, that when he has an opportunity to exact a revenge, so to speak, he's going to relish it.
Maybe it's because our weather has been so good this fall, but I found myself in the car a lot on Sundays so far this fall, which is great because I've gotten to listen to even more of your broadcasts. And you do, seriously, I'm not just saying it because you're here. You know how much I respect you. You do such a great job on the games. I love listening to your broadcasts, and I learn as a broadcaster every time I get to listen to you.
Well, I really appreciate that, coming from a pro like yourself and someone who, you know, has been at the craft for a long, long time. I try to get better every week. I mean, I listen to other guys, and I feel the same way you just expressed. I love doing what we get to do. We're both very fortunate, especially where we get to do it. And it's always a work in progress, Rich, and always trying to get better at it, trying to find new ways to describe things, and try to increase my knowledge about the path, the league, football in general, and hopefully that comes across. A big part of it, too, is I think we have a tremendous product on the field. So when you're calling games for a team like the Patriots and they win as often as they do, and to kind of circle back to where we began, even when they're 4-2, if that's a disappointment, well, you're in a pretty good place, and the broadcasts are going to sound a lot better than, say, if you're broadcasting in Cleveland these days.
Well, you're also going to be seeing, I'm sure, this weekend, one of the best and one of the nicest guys in our business. If you get a chance, pass along my best wishes to our friend Wes Durham down there in Atlanta.
Oh, you better believe it, and he is. He's a great guy, and I had an opportunity at a very young age coming out of college to spend a year at the University of North Carolina as an intern in their sports information office, which meant that I prepared game notes for Wes's dad, Woody Durham, the longtime legendary voice of the North Carolina Tar Heels. And although Woody's had some health issues the last couple of years, he remains a larger-than-life figure in Chapel Hill in North Carolina. And you think about a guy like Wes, who followed his dad into the business, you couldn't find a more down-to-earth, accessible, approachable guy in our field than Wes Durham. Does a great job on college basketball and football. Some fans are going to hear him, in fact, on the BC-Virginia game this weekend. I'll be calling that game for the ACC Network, and then he's going to fly up to Providence and call the Patriots and the Falcons on Sunday night. But he is a real good guy, and I will definitely pass that along.
Well, Bob, enjoy the game. We'll be listening this weekend. Always appreciate you making time for us, and we look forward to talking with you again soon.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Rich. Thanks so much.
That's Patriots broadcaster Bob Soucy getting things rolling here on the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. Brought to you by Quirk Auto Group, quirkauto.com. It's your car. Find it at Quirk. When we come back, we talk with Ileana Douglas of TCM's Trailblazing Women. It's Downtown on the Pulse, AM 620 WZON.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Biking season is here, and the only way to be sure that you're road or trail ready is to bring your bike to Slipping Gears Cycling, Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts. At 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, before prime riding season slips away. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates, shop in person, and online at slippinggears.com. CrossInsurance.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit CrossInsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on in to Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
Penobscot Theater presents...
You're just another dirty birdie.
A romance novelist injured in a crash.
Darling, relax. I'm a trained nurse.
Now held hostage.
I'm your number one fan.
Writing as if his life depends on it, because it does. The main premiere of a Stephen King classic, Misery, at Bangor's historic Opera House, October 12th through November 5th. Tickets at 942-3333, penobscottheater.org.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. My company is ClearPoint Financial. We're an independent retirement plan advisory firm located right here in Bangor, Maine. At ClearPoint Financial, we provide guidance-based, comprehensive retirement plan solutions to companies that are concerned about their employees' retirement income security. We focus on plan participants. We help them strive to achieve retirement income security. We provide ongoing engagement, education, investment advice, and service that exceeds expectation. For more details on our financial wellness programs, call me today at 899-2552. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Welcome back. Sunday morning, Best of Downtown. Rich Kimball, Kerry Haskell here with you. Had fun this week visiting again on our show with actress and author Ileana Douglas. Last time we talked about her wonderful book, I Blame Dennis Hopper. This time around, the conversation focused on her work on the TCM series Trailblazing Women that airs every Monday night through the month of October. Ileana, first of all, thank you so much for coming back on with us. I have to say, the last time you were on with us, one of our favorite conversations we've ever had on the show.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you. Well, I'll try to top myself.
Well, I have no doubt that you'll be able to do that. Let's talk about what's going on this month, the third year of this initiative with TCM, Trailblazing Women. It's been so wonderful. I mean, I knew a little bit about Ruth Gordon and Betty Comden, but to learn about some of the real pioneers like Jeanne McPherson, Bess Meredith, and the fact that women have been instrumental in filmmaking since the very beginning.
Yes, especially... And what I love about doing the show is every year I learn a new name. And for me, one of the names that really stood out, June Mathis, who discovered Rudolph Valentino, who created him, created his image, produced Ben-Hur from 1926. Ben-Hur written by a woman, Bess Meredith produced by a woman, you know, and it's this epic, it's the largest. You know, I think it had a cast of about 100,000 people shot over a four-year period. I mean, the best of what the motion picture business, you know, was just crazy.
And you've had a chance to talk to some pretty influential and important women in the industry as well.
Yes. Again, another highlight for me this year, Callie Curry, who I so admire, you know, Academy Award-winning screenwriter. Of Thelma and Louise, and so much a part of, I think, you know, a discussion that's going on now with women in film. So Callie Curry, but editors like Lindsay Klingman, who edited One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and worked with Milos Forman, and Marianne Brandon, who's, you know, again, worked with J.J. Abrams, Stephanie Elaine, producer of Hustle and Flow, and Leslie Dixon wrote all these great rom-coms, adapted Mrs. Doubtfire. So, again, it's great to go this year behind the scenes with all these people.
We've got what we call as friends of the show, our main mafia that's working in Hollywood, people like Katie Hazelton and Caitlin Fitzgerald, Anna Kendrick, Gita Palopoli, and so many of them are involved in several different aspects of the industry. Is it even, I mean, obviously it helps anybody in the business, but is it even more vital that women can wear different hats to achieve success?
Well, I think that what we've shown on the show is that women were always wearing different hats. Mm. You mentioned Ruth Gordon. She started out as an actress. She did plays. She wrote books. She collaborated with her husband and wrote screenplays. And then she went back to acting later in life. Virginia Van Upp, who is a producer who worked uncredited under Harry Kahn, wrote most of Gilda uncredited. So I think that, you know, women are always behind the scenes, even in a film like Taxi Driver. The editor was a woman, Marsha Lucas, Julia Phillips was a woman. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily think of Taxi Driver as a sensitive female picture. But again, it just shows that somewhere along the line, we got this divide of like a woman's movie or a man's movie. And I think that the best movies are a combination of the two. And again, example is a film like Taxi Driver. Another example is a producer we highlight, Kathleen Kennedy, who I've had the privilege of working with, who's just been an incredible producer and now a studio head.
All of this happening, of course, while the scandal hits the news about Harvey Weinstein and the challenges that people knew about, but not to the degree that they've had to deal with all these years. Is this the start of hopefully creating a better environment for women in the industry?
I think it obviously it is. It does have a kind of wall coming tumbling down feeling. You know, there's going to be a lot of pain and heartache right now. You know, one of the things that I've tried to do, again, is just to, I'm glad that the show is here, to focus on some positive things of men and women working successfully together, you know, and hopefully, again, the idea is that, you know, that we've had the majority of these, you know, great experiences and collaborations, and hopefully that will, you know, that will continue. And obviously there's no place for that kind of mentality. But it's going to be a lot of pain and heartache right now. But I think looking back over Hollywood history, it's good that these conversations are having, not so much in the, you know, in the terrible context, which is current, but again, one of the women we're focusing on is, you know, this woman, Virginia Van Upp. And, you know, I mean, again, like she just never really got her due. And, you know, I pulled a story on her, you know, and the headline was Paul Bunyan was a sissy compared to Virginia Van Upp, gal producer, whose achievements have earned her the label Dainty Dynamite. You know, so that must not have been fun for her, you know, to be. So I think that one of the great things about the show, too, is highlighting all sorts of oppression and honoring these women. And, you know, we don't think of Gilda. I never thought of Gilda as a movie that was really the force behind it was Virginia Van Upp. I mean, that was completely her project from start to finish. So it's a way to reevaluate these great movies and look for more movies that, you know, that these women have been involved with. I mean, that was one of the great things was after about June Mathis. It's like you discover all these other films that they've done. And I think that I've tried to just take a positive approach to, you know, some of the heartache that's been going on.
We're talking with Ileana Douglas here on Downtown. There are more opportunities, certainly, for women behind the camera as directors, but is there still a perception among a lot of people that any film directed by a woman must be a quote-unquote woman's movie?
Well, again, this is something that became, you know, and that's why I thought it was important to have somebody like Callie Curry on. The first time the phrase chick flick was used, it was meant to be a positive term in terms of Thelma and Louise as a kind of an empowering phrase. It then became a kind of derogatory phrase of like, oh, it's a movie for women about women. And that's how it you know, so it became a negative stereotype. But again, going to the past of all these movies and looking at them, there was no such thing as, you know, a male movie, a female movie. There were female stars, but there were writers behind it. I mean, another great example of a woman that we highlight is J. Preston Allen, you know, who wrote the screenplay of Marnie, The Prime of Miss Jean Brody, and then the movie that we show is Cabaret. But she went on to write Prince in the City and had a, you know, a really great collaboration with Sidney Lumet. And so, you know, Prince in the City, again, not a woman's picture. So I think that, you know, you've got to take, you know, hopefully what I love about doing the show is taking away that stereotype of, okay, well, we have to get a woman director for this. We have to get a male director for this. This is a woman's story. That's a man's story. Instead of look at the body of work. What does this, you know, woman bring to the picture, and why would she be good for this kind of a film? And it takes a little bit of imagination, I think.
Our current political climate is also a reminder, too, that women have always faced challenges when stepping into what have been viewed as traditional male arenas, and you experienced that in your own family. Of course, with your grandmother getting attacked by Richard Nixon back in the late 1940s.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we've always got that. You know, that's women being silenced is you know, nothing new where I come from. But, you know, you can't let it get into your psyche. You have to kind of persevere. And I think that if you believe in the story, you know, the story will get told. I do think that women have to step up to the plate and not be afraid. And also, big thing that I learn every year is to take credit for what you have written and write it down. You know, men traditionally have been very, very good at, you know, obscuring the input that women have made on their films. That's why we do the show every year, to highlight, you know, to highlight the work of somebody like Dee Dee Allen, you know, again, the editor for Bonnie and Clyde and so many other movies. And, you know, Dee Dee Allen basically created a modern form of editing with Bonnie and Clyde that every other editor since then has kind of copied. And I think that if you can look at the past and alongside that, Arthur Penn was the person who gave her the job. And Warren Beatty defended her, you know, when Jack Warner, who was, you know, very sexist, he didn't want her to be on the movie. You know, somebody like Warren Beatty stepped in and they protected her. And so I think, again, it's always in this collaboration of, you know, of working together. That's when things, I think, work the best.
I went back and reread, and I love the book, but both times I've read it, I blame Dennis Hopper, which is just such a wonderful read. And a story, the last time you were on, we talked a lot about the book, but we didn't get to discuss the story, and I wonder if you could share some of it, of your encounter with Rudy Valley.
Oh, well, my encounter with Rudy Valley from a very young age was when I was, I had gotten a little job at a dinner theater. I lied about my age and got this little job working there. And I was a kind of a quirky kid. So I was one of the few people who actually knew who Rudy Valley was, but I would watch him, you know, kind of night after night. It's just really being impressed with his performance. And I was backstage, you know, trying to watch the performance. And I think he just mistakenly, because it was such a low rent theater, I was standing there and he was kind of struggling with his costume, and I came to his aid, and I suddenly, a bell went off in my head, and I thought, oh, okay, I'll be here tomorrow night. And that way I'll pretend like it's a role, and I'll somehow, like, I'm here with your coat, Mr. Valley. And so you know, we established a little bit of a rapport. And what I mean by that was me saying, "Great show, sir," and him saying, "Thank you," and then like walking by. But, you know, but by the end of the week, you know, I guess he saw some little spark in me or something. I really enjoyed the show. He brought me back to his dressing room and played, you know, put on this tape machine. And I was listening, and I thought it was The Ocean. I didn't know what he was playing. And he said, "Do you know what that is?" And I said, "Is it The Ocean?" And he said, "No, it's My Applause. I listen to it every night, you know." And it was such a poignant kind of a reminder of, you know, no matter where you are, that this idea that if you could play back the applause and the joy that you've given people in your life, it's not a bad way, you know, to live your life. And so it always kind of stayed with me, the sort of the poignancy of that. He was quite old at the time, still out there, you know, plugging. And I've always had a soft spot for older entertainers, you know, just to see, you know, what they've gone through. And again, somebody like him, who is, you know, one of the top, you go in his day, the top people in America in terms of fame. And then, you know, cut to, you know, 1979, and he's at a broken down dinner theater in the middle of the woods listening to his applause. So, you know, it's always like a gentle reminder, just like it's all about the journey.
Well, and I was struck in reading it about how hard he worked in that dinner theater, because 2 or 3 years before that, I was in college, and he came up here to the University of Maine because he had had a big hit recording the Maine Stein song back in the 1920s, and they decked him out in the raccoon coat and had an old car, yep. And he came out and had to be in his mid to late 70s at the time, and even then, did that song as if he was at the Hollywood Bowl.
That's it's funny you say that, because that's how I felt. It was like once he got out there, you know, and sang, in particular, as I wrote in the book, my fate was this, you know, a vagabond lover. You know, it wasn't a dry eye in the house. You know, it just was. Here was a man who invented a style of singing called crooning, and somebody like Frank Sinatra listened to that, and Bing Crosby, and you know, it's the very root of what show business is, and I've always been a kind of a student of that. But and it's good to remember the name Rudy Vallee.
One of the giants that you became friends with through the years, we lost not too long ago, Jerry Lewis. Can you talk about your relationship with Jerry and why he felt a special kinship with you?
I can only describe it in the same way that. You know, my love for these performers and my respect for their contributions, you know, you can't be taught that. You just know it. You know, people always say to me, "How do you know so much about movies?" It was like, well, I started when I was about 4. So, you know, it becomes kind of a way of life. And I was always a fan of Jerry's movies, particularly some of the ones he did with Frank Cashlin, the color films. You know, Cinderfella, Nutty Professor, you know, the Ladies Man, those are some of my favorites. And his musical contributions were always what got me, because I love music. And I always thought he was such a great dancer. And so I think initially when we first met, you know, we had in common, I was working for Turner Classic Movies, and we would just talk about movies because, you know, I'm going to ask him questions about Jack Benny because he knew Jack Benny. And I think that, you know, when you spot in someone that they have a genuine interest in learning and becoming a better filmmaker and a better artist, I think that was, you know, what he saw in me initially. And then it just turned into just a great, you know, great friendship where you could, I miss him every day, where I think I can't pick up the phone and get words of wisdom from somebody like Jerry Lewis. You know, somebody like Jerry has, you know, they've seen it all. They've been on the top and they've been on the bottom and they've come back and, you know, they are again at the very roots of show business, which is which is coming out of vaudeville. And once people like him are gone, that's it. So, it's kind of like, you know, when Jerry Lewis calls you, you pick up the phone. Like, you never, I mean, I remember, I think, doing press for Trailblazing Women, and I said, oh, there's just one thing. If Jerry Lewis calls me, I'm just going to have to step out. And they were like, what? No, but we're live on a radio show. And I was like, I'm sorry, it's Jerry Lewis. You know, so you just, you know, it's a privilege to spend time with him, interview him, and even recently speak at his memorial. It's like one of the great honors of my life, of getting to know him and learning from him, not only as a filmmaker, but as a human being.
Well, it's a privilege for us to have a chance to talk with you again. Love the series Trailblazing Women on TCM.
Thank
Your
you.
Podcast is absolutely terrific as well, and it's a delight for us to have you back on.
Oh, thank you. Anytime.
Ileana Douglas here on The Best of Downtown, your Sunday morning. When we come back, analog or digital, which side do you come down on? We'll talk with author Damon Krukowski, his book, The New Analog, next on The Pulse, AM 620 WZON.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Whatever you're looking for, G&M Family Market has got what you need. They're on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. They have fresh produce delivered daily, a great selection of meats and seafood, beer and wine, a Dunkin' Donuts right there, and an Amato's as well. And if there's something you can't find, just ask, and they'll make every effort to get it for you next time. It's G&M Family Market, Route 1A, Route 46 in Holden. They're open every day from 6 in the morning until 9 p.m.
There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
Go Blue!
Sir, you're here for the cheerleading tryouts?
Yeah, for the class of 82. Gotta show my school spirit.
I know a better way. The UMaine Alumni Signature Rewards Visa Card from University Credit Union. Low rates, no annual fees, and it earns reward points for travel, merchandise, or cash back.
Woo, sounds easier than a backflip.
Apply online today at UMaineAlumniCard.com.
Federally insured by NCUA. Terms and conditions apply, subject to credit approval.
Polaris is now at Friend and Friend in Orono. Polaris side-by-sides, Polaris Rangers, Polaris Razors, Polaris ATVs, Polaris snowmobiles. The Polaris factory authorized clearance is going on now, with massive rebates up to $2,500 on non-currents, making now the time to buy. On-the-spot financing. Get your off-road vehicle today at Friend and Friend Polaris in Orono. Easy on, easy off. Exit 193 on I-95, just 5 minutes from Hogan Road. Polaris at Friend and Friend in Orono, now.
You know Green Acres Kennel Shop in Bangor is your pet's home away from home, but did you know they've been voted Bangor Region's best pet? pet store for the 11th consecutive year? Green Acres carries a wide variety of pet food and supplies at competitive prices, along with a rewards program and frequent buyer programs. Their commitment to your pet's well-being is always number one. Learn more about Green Acres Kennel Shop at greenacreskennel.com or stop by and see them at 1653 Union Street in Bangor.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, our home away from home.
We back. Best of Downtown, Sunday morning. Rich Kimble, Kerry Haskell, here on The Pulse. Up next on The Best of Downtown, we had a chance this week to talk with musician and author Damon Krukowski. Fascinating new book entitled The New Analog. Here's that conversation on The Best of Downtown. Such an interesting read, and you know, as radio guys, I think we're even more fascinated by this. And I want to go back to the basic question, which is, you know, when and why did we decide as a people that noise was a bad thing?
Yeah, I feel like you know, that's happening to us online without our signing onto it. Like a lot of things that happen in your digital life, you just kind of click boxes and you don't really get much of a choice. Like those terms of agreement that we all have to agree to, you know. Mm. And I think the lack of noise is one of them, because digital audio and digital information in general is very efficient and very cheap. These are the positives. And one of the ways that it gets to be that way is by highlighting signal, the information you want, and eliminating noise, the information you don't want. The problem is that you don't really get the choice to say what information you want and don't want yourself. The decision's made by other people. It's made by corporations. It's made by software designers. And not necessarily evilly intentioned. I think sometimes very good intentions. But at the same time, it's a lot of decisions that are removed from our own realm.
I was laughing out loud and recalling, as a young guy, buying my first adult stereo system back in the day and being so excited to have that Dolby noise reduction. And as you explained, it was just awful and didn't help. It made the music much worse.
Yeah, sometimes it did. It's true. Well, you know, Dolby was to get rid of tape hiss. And certainly on cassettes, there was a lot of tape hiss. But that kind of noise of the medium itself, like the surface noise on an LP, or the static on the radio when you're listening, you know, especially to AM these days, you get a lot of interference. But those things can be eliminated by digital media. But I think we got to really think what we're throwing away with that. It's not just a bothersome thing. You know, when I'm listening to the radio, I feel like, you know, it's live. You know, it's being broadcast. And I think feel like part of the clue to that sense of immediacy on radio is the static. You know, it's being interfered with. I mean, when there's a lightning strike, you hear the lightning over your radio, and that sense of connection that I don't think you really get when you just have audio on demand. You know, like a podcast, it can sound like radio, but it's not radio because it happens in your own time. And it happens without any noise. There's no noise of transmission. It just emerges out of that black digital silence. Mm.
Speaking of the podcast, the Way of Hearing podcast, I listened to. I haven't listened to all six of them yet, but I am through them. Your first one, you talked with Joe Castiglione a little bit, and sort of that immediacy of the broadcast and how it's changed a little bit in Boston, with the fact that the radio and the TV no longer sync up, and it's changed a little bit of what you hear as far as fan reaction sometimes.
Exactly, yeah. I tell the story in the book, which, because it's something I noticed. As soon as television switched over to digital in the whole country, you couldn't line up the radio broadcast with the TV anymore, because the radio was still analog, but the digital broadcast of television was going through a different system, and it arrives later. So Joe Castiglione would call the play, and then you'd see it on your screen. And that breaking of the illusion of it all happening at the instant, I found very kind of sad and painful. I mean, it used to be that really I could open the windows in my neighborhood, and when the Red Sox hit a home run, I heard it. I heard everybody cheer. And now, you know, everybody's getting the information in these digital sources. It actually physically arrives at a different time. Now, am I mistaken, or are you guys a Red Sox radio network station?
Yeah, we are a Red Sox affiliate.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm so glad to know that you're still on AM in Maine, because, you know, that's another thing. Here in Boston, they've switched over to FM for the Red Sox broadcasts. And that kind of made me sad, too, I have to say. That bit was just nostalgia. But I like my Red Sox in mono. I don't know why. I don't need to hear Joe in stereo.
Now, I have a somewhat different perspective. I do play-by-play for University of Maine football. And occasionally, not all the time, but occasionally when there's a TV broadcast at the same time as my radio broadcast, the delay will be very slight, and it sometimes, if it syncs up properly, it makes me look smarter than I am as I say it just slightly before it happens.
That's very good. Yeah, we could, you know, if you could get a fast enough connection, you could place bets on the Red Sox. You know, listen to Joe before anybody sees what happens.
I also, when you talk about the decisions being made by others, and you talk about streaming audio services and music services, and gosh, how lazy as a people have we become? I mean, I grew up making mixtapes and taking great pride as a disc jockey in my early radio days of sequencing the music properly, but now we even turn that over to some sort of logarithms and algorithms that will tell us what song we want to hear next.
Right, and I think the big difference there is that instead of turning it over to another person, you know, a DJ, for example, or, you know, your friend who's making you a mixtape, you're turning it over to a machine, to artificial intelligence, really. And again, I don't think I've met some of the people who work for Spotify building those algorithms, and they are really fantastically intelligent people and well-meaning, some of them. I don't think it's necessarily that they're out to, you know, defraud us. I think they're out to provide a convenient service that people will love. And then, you know, so on the one hand, it's like, well, okay, that makes complete sense. On the other hand, you got to think about what you're trading. And I think, you know, we end up trading a human person on the other side with their personal choices that you learn from with an algorithm that's really built off of your own taste. And if you just get your own taste reflected back at you, I think that's where we get this problem we're all facing now in all kinds of parts of our lives, of these filter bubbles where you just get more of the same back at you, you know? And I think that to break through that, it's really a very simple thing. It's as simple as reaching out to another person, like another person with different views and different taste, and letting yourself learn from them. But that very basic human gesture is actually kind of hard to make online because it's so convenient to let the machines do it for you online. You know, and they do it so well sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, the Spotify, if you ever tried the Discover feature on Spotify, it's remarkable, I find. I've heard from friends with small children that if they let them use their Spotify account, it doesn't work as well, because then you get mixed up taste, you know, whatever your taste is mixed with,
right,
you know, a 5-year-old's taste. But if you keep your account to yourself, it is really, I find, remarkable. But what you get back is music that you like. Now, that's not a bad thing, but what about, how do you find music that you've never dreamed of before? Mm. You know, and maybe you don't like it, but that's how you find out what you really like, or that's how you grow. You know, you get challenged by things. Like, you know, the University of Maine, I was just up there teaching for a couple of days and giving a talk, and I enjoyed being with the students so much, and they were so eager to hear some new information. And I thought that was so, you know, just a simple, wonderful exchange. But that's an exchange that's hard to do online. You know, if you think about it, when you go Googling, generally you find the answers to the questions you posed, but nobody says to you, why did you ask that question? Or maybe there's a better question to ask in the first place. That's the kind of thing a friend can say to you, or, you know, someone with more knowledge of the subject that you're looking into. But it's not the thing the machine says back to you.
One of the things that struck me in the book was your discussion of how the cell phone technology has sort of been engineered to lower noise, but one of the big things you lose is that sense of place and sort of the nuances of what the person are saying to you. Mm-hmm. whether they're whispering to you or they're yelling at you, you lose a lot of that in the translation.
Right.
Now, the engineers have their reasoning for obviously making it clear, but is anybody sort of thinking, or is there pressure to, you know, go back and get some of that sense of place put back in?
Yeah, that's the funny thing. I think there really isn't. I think because we're all so, you know, we're so quick to adopt these useful, efficient online tools. There's very little pushback on these companies. The other problem I find, I mean, this is speaking from my own experience as a musician, an indie musician, is that, you know, the companies that we deal with for music now, like Apple Music and Spotify and Pandora, these are gigantic corporations. They really don't want to hear from me. And they don't really, turns out, want to hear from anybody in my entire genre of music. And then when I meet people who are, you know, more, have more commercial careers, it turns out they don't want to hear from them either, you know, because they're so big. You know, it's like be way beyond you can't fight City Hall. This is like you can't fight Google. You know, you can't fight Apple. These are gigantic international corporations, and they really aren't polling us for what we're missing. You know, I think we just keep being given the product, and the products work. They're really well designed. They're clever. They give us new tools, and we go with it. But there's no moment where you say, oh, wait a minute, you know, I kind of miss when you picked up the phone, you heard the background noise of where the person was you're talking to. That was useful information. You know, now we go around, we're forever saying on our cell phones where we are. You know, where are you? Or, you know, you hear people on the street and all they're saying is like, I'm on the street, you know. It's like, you know, if the cell phone wasn't engineered that way, you wouldn't have to do that. You'd know where you were.
Do you think that's sort of, is there going to be people that will search that out on their own? And I know there's an increasing market for vinyl and people, is that nostalgia or is that people searching for a return to the analog place?
Yeah, I think it's a little of both, actually, is my hunch. I mean, I don't have any kind of, you know, data for that. I really just anecdotal, but I meet people who are definitely into it for nostalgia. But then I meet a lot of young people buying vinyl, and I think they're really exploring. And I think that they are interested in another way of hearing music and of experiencing music and having the package there and having the precious object. There's something very fresh about that for people who haven't grown up with it. So I think it cuts two ways. I mean, they're definitely, when you go to the record store now, you see a lot of gray-haired people like me, and that's, you know, partly nostalgia or holding on to old habits. But then you see a lot of people in their 20s. And the vinyl boom, so-called, is actually being driven, as I understand it, from people in the industry by younger buyers. So that's a whole new thing for them. And I think that's great. But it takes, you know, it takes a lot of resources to press a record, more than it does to put out something online. So, you know, it raises the bar, and it can make it just more expensive and harder to do, harder to distribute. You're back to all those old problems. But actually, it's a little even more difficult than it was at the height of vinyl, because there are fewer distribution channels now. There are fewer pressing plants. They're very oversubscribed. And records are really expensive in the store. I'm shocked by how much people are charging. But when we press vinyl now for ourselves, then we learn why, which is it's more expensive than it used to be. And I think that's just supply and demand. There are fewer pressing plants left. So many were junked.
We're talking with Damon Krukowski, author of The New Analog. And when it comes to listening to music, too, to me, the concerns are twofold. Number one is if you're listening to digital audio, you're not getting the true sound. It's so compressed. But you also lose the communal aspect of it. Some of my favorite memories of listening to albums when people did that sort of thing and discovering new music was listening to it with friends and talking about it and picking things out together. And now everybody's in their own isolated little oral world.
Yeah, I find that very strange too, because I similarly always experienced music as a social phenomenon, a social art. And of course, that's what it is when you go out to hear it live. And it's been interesting to me to, you know, you think about this boom in live music that's been going on, which is true. And that is a way of reintroducing the social aspect of music. But there's a much simpler way than going to these expensive festivals, which is just listen to music on speakers, you know, in a room with other people. You know, I was teaching for a while, college freshmen here in Boston, and I would talk to them about what kind of music they listened to in their dorm rooms, and it turned out they never discussed it with one another with their roommates because they each were on their own headphones, so you didn't have to have those debates, which I remember being rather vicious at times, of whose music was worth listening to, you know. If you didn't like your roommate's record collection, there was a lot of negotiation went on. But again, that gets back to hearing what you don't like. I mean, sometimes it's really good to hear what you don't like and not just be always comfortable.
Yeah, when I was in college, I mean, that two of the bands that I still really love listening to were because roommates listened to them. You know, yeah. The Violent Femmes, a band I had never heard of growing up in Howland. My roommate came up from Connecticut. It was one of the bands he listened to. You know, I the Talking Heads. In even before college, I happened to work with at a guy at a McDonald's that brought rap music up when he came here from St. Louis. Yeah. He brought a box full of cassettes with him, and you know, it's 1985, and I'm listening to Sugar Hill Gang and
amazing.
You know, Grandmaster Flash and all these bands that nobody in Maine pretty much was listening to or had heard of.
Yeah.
So you lose that communal aspect of the listening.
Absolutely. And also, and another aspect which you're raising right now, which is the mix from communities, you know, where you hear other people's music, other communities' music, other people's music, other parts of the country, music that you wouldn't hear otherwise. And when everyone's in their headphones, you just don't hear it. I grew up in New York City in the 70s. It became a kind of a social problem or issue for the city to deal with, which was boomboxes on the subway.
Right.
You know? They even ended up passing a law outlawing them. But, you know, what boomboxes on the subway were doing was sharing the music. I mean, at times it could be used aggressively, but it could also be used really joyfully. And I certainly was exposed to a whole lot of music that I would never have heard otherwise if it weren't for, you know, the sometimes rather intimidating person with the gigantic boombox playing it really loud in the subway. And now, you know, you go in the train and it's silent. You know, everyone's on their own headphones. And sometimes I just wish, like, you could know what they were all hearing. Somehow, you know, share it. Beam into their feed somehow. But that's not where we're at, and that's not where the companies seem to be interested in taking us.
Well, it's a fascinating conversation. The book is really a wonderful read, The New Analog. Damon Krukowski, thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon.
Such a pleasure. Thank you very much. Long live AM radio.
It's Damon Krukowski, the book called The New Analog. It's the best of downtown. Wrapping up for your Sunday morning, thanks to Damon. Actress Ileana Douglas, voice of the Patriots, Bob Soucy, for joining us this morning on the program. Don't forget Casey Kasem, American Top 40, the 80s, coming up next. And we got a load of good stuff ahead for you in the week to come on Downtown. On Monday's show, well, the usual suspects, Mike Lowe of the Portland Press Herald, Maine football coach Joe Harris-Simiak, Alan Adams of the Maine Edge with movie reviews on Pass the Popcorn, and a return visit to the show from best-selling author Bruce Cameron. A lot of books about dogs. A Dog's Purpose, the big one, that, of course, led to the movie as well. His latest, just out a while ago, is entitled A Dog's Journey. And for dog people, it's another tearjerker. We'll talk with Bruce about that tomorrow afternoon on the program. And as the week rolls on, we'll check in with our friend Colin Fleming for a little bit of music talk, Kyle Draper of Comcast Sportsnet New England, and much more in the days ahead here on Downtown. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. Will you be occupied with yard work, or what have you got going on today, Kerry?
I think just rest and relaxation.
I remember
those. That's my big plan.
I am, since we have taped this ahead of time, I'm hoping I'm still asleep because I will have arrived back from Albany about an hour and a half ago.
It's a long drive.
It's an awful long drive. But, you know, probably, being that there's a little guy around, probably I've been up for 4 hours already. Either way, thanks for joining us and making us a part of your Sunday. Enjoy the rest of it, and we hope you'll join us tomorrow afternoon for Downtown, starting at 4, right here on the Pulse, AM 620, WZON. You're gonna be all